So tonight's talk is entitled Skill in Questioning, and here's a quote from Einstein. If I had an hour to solve a problem and my life depended on the answer, I would spend the first 55 minutes figuring out the proper questions to ask. For if I knew the proper questions, I could solve the problem in less than 5 minutes. And the Buddha felt the same way too. And that's what we're going to go into. And I have to tell you why I got interested in this topic. It was due to a newspaper article. I think it was about 10 days ago. And it was entitled, Hannity, Wallace, and Why Trump Wants to Control Follow-Up Questions. And I am not going into politics, I'm going into questions and the importance of questioning. And the headline, this is by a woman who writes for the Washington Post, Margaret Sullivan, and she was asking this. And I don't know if you remembered, but President Trump had suggested from now on at his news conference there would be no more follow-up questions. He has said he'd like to put that into effect. And so she wrote this article about that and the importance of questions. And so what she did was compare, first of all, she says it's a terrible idea. And you could really tell by two interviews that took place, one by Sean Hannity and one by Chris Wallace. And Sean Hannity asked him a question about Matthew Whitaker. And did he think he was a good choice? And Trump said, yes, he's a great choice, and that was it, and there was no follow-up questions. And so then Chris Wallace, in another interview, asked him, and I'm not going to go into all of this and read the whole transcript, but you get the idea about how important questions are, said, did you know before you appointed him that he had had that record and that he was so critical of Robert Mueller? And Trump said, I did not know that. I did not know he took views on the Mueller investigation as such. Wallace, and when did you find that out? And when you found that out, what did you think? And Trump said, it has no effect on me. And Wallace says, he says there's no collusion. And he says, you can starve the investigation. And Trump says, well, what do you do when a person's right? There is no collusion. And then he goes on in a long diatribe about that. I reason that the fact that he would have been wrong, if he had said there's no collusion, he's right. Wallace asks again, if Mueller decides that he wants to subpoena you, the Attorney General, Whitaker said he can block that. You tweeted this week about, quote, Bob Mueller and his gang of Democrats. Trump said, right. Wallace said, if Whitaker decides in any way to limit or curtail the Mueller investigation, are you okay with that? Trump, look, he, Whitaker, it's up to him. He's an astute politician. He's smart. He's respected. I'll let him do what he thinks is best. So the conclusion was, as Margaret Sullivan writes, and there you have it, Trump nailed down to say that he's comfortable with his acting attorney general curtailing the special counsel investigation. So just bring that up because that was skillful questioning. You know, to get to a point, to a truth, to an answer that wasn't happening with just one arbitrary question and thinking that you are going to get the appropriate answer. So my purpose was not to castigate any particular politician. It really was to show it's true. I'm not doing that. But I do like the, what is it called, aphorism? A pithy saying. There is no right answer. There are only right questions. So do you remember the last question you asked of anybody? Can you remember it at all?
What brought you to sit?
That's a good one. Well, yeah, I was going to say take a moment to recall it. For most of us, we can't remember because questions are such a ubiquitous part of our conversation. We use them for so many reasons, not always to get information, which the standard answer is to get information, but just to make small talk. Often we don't even pay attention to the answer. We're just doing the formulaic, how are you? Do we really care? Not really. How's your kids? Who cares? You know, like that. It goes on and on. So we use questions for many different reasons, but tonight I want to define a question as an information-seeking act. That's what we're doing here. That's what the Buddha taught when he talked about the various ways of asking questions and the questions you should answer and the questions you shouldn't answer. So how we ask questions, what are the most skillful? You know, surprisingly, as I was looking this up and investigating, and it's always fun to teach and, you know, get to research and investigate these kind of things, not too many people thought about the type of questions to ask. Socrates came closest with the Socratic method, but he really didn't classify the kind of questions he asked, although he certainly made a poignant statement when he was convicted in the Athenian court for corrupting youth, and he was convicted to death. And he said, the unexamined life is not worth living. And this is very similar to Buddhist practice, Buddhist philosophy. The Buddha actually was a contemporary of Socrates, which I had not realized. I don't think they knew each other. I don't think they traveled that far, but they did live in the same time period. So the Buddha, as far as I can see, is the only one that actually looked into the kind of questions to ask and what they were for and what you would gain from asking these particular questions. And that's what I want to go into tonight. And the very second to last statement by the Buddha before he died in the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, the second to last statement was, I'm going to read this, before his death, the very last statement he said, strive with diligence, essentially be your own teacher. Take these teachings and do with them what you will, but be skillful, do not cause harm. But the second to last statement was, and this is from the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, then the Blessed One addressed the bhikkhus, meaning the monks, saying, it may be, bhikkhus, that one of you is in doubt or perplexity as to the Buddha, the Dhamma, or the Sangha, the path or the practice. Then question, bhikkhus, do not be given to remorse later on with the thought, the Master was with us face to face, yet face to face we failed to ask him. Right before he dies. So what do you think they asked him? Anybody have any idea? What would be the burning question? You have this genius who's about to die. Yes?
Who will be the teacher now?
That was a question, but that wasn't an answer to this. But that, yes, you're absolutely right. That was a little prior to it in the sutta, but yes. But not at this point. Yeah.
Do you fear death?
No. That's a good one, though. I think I... Yeah. Yeah.
What are you thinking about?
That's another good one.
For me, the most important question in my life was, why am I in pain and suffering? Why am I addicted to drugs?
Mm-hmm.
Why?
Mm-hmm. That would be a good question to ask the Buddha, too. But that wasn't what the bhikkhus asked. Yeah.
What do we do once you're gone?
That's another good one. Yeah, Ginger.
How do I accept the present moment?
You guys are great. You're asking wonderful questions. Actually, they didn't ask him anything. They were quiet, which seems rather odd to me, and I've read this sutta and this ending a number of times, that here you have this genius, you know, this path that they've been following, and there was no questions at the end. And Ananda says to the Buddha, when nobody has any questions, well, you've just taught us so well that everything is absolutely clear. Okay, that's kind of nice, but no, there was no questions at the end. So the Buddha, there are three suttas, and I read this book called Skill and Questioning by Thanissaro Bhikkhu. Does everybody know who he is? Well, he's a very orthodox Theravadan monk. He's a brilliant guy. I've met him a few times when I was in community Dharma leader training at Gil Fronsdell's Sangha. He would invite Thanissaro Bhikkhu in to speak to us, and we were allowed to ask any questions we wanted of him. Gil did say the caveat was, remember, he's an orthodox monk, and you are lay people. And so you got to keep that in mind. How an orthodox Buddhist monk lives and how lay people live are two different things, and the questions are going to be answered differently as well. But he did write this, I think, very good book, and it's called Skill and Questioning, which is where I'm getting most of my information from in tonight's talk. And he said there's three suttas that address skill and questioning. And Guttara Nikaya 442, 468, and then Digha Nikaya 33. And Guttara Nikaya are the short discourses, and they usually have to deal with numbers. So there's going to be four categories of questions, so it's the fourth number. Digha Nikaya are the long discourses, and they are long. Extremely long. I did you the favor and read 33 myself, so you don't have to, and I've got the important elements of it. So here is from, because this is the most pithy, succinct way of describing the four different kinds of questions, from Anguttara Nikaya 442. There are these four ways of answering questions. Which four? There are questions that should be answered categorically, straightforward. Yes, no, this, that. There are questions that should be, and I'll give you an example right now for that, although I'm going to go into more detail. You just said, is Dick Cheney dead or not? We were talking about that. That's a categorical question. There's no, it's going to be yes or no. This or that. So, yeah. And I didn't know. Is he?
No.
No, okay.
Where was he?
At
the funeral the other day.
Was he? I didn't see him.
Anyway, so categorical questions. There are questions that should be answered categorically. Yes, no, this, that. There are questions that should be answered with analytical answers, defining or redefining the terms of the questions. There are questions that should be answered with a counter question, and there are questions that should be put aside and not answered. These are the four ways of answering questions, so we're going to go into those. And one of the reasons I want to go into these is I think they're very applicable to our daily life. There's a lot of wisdom here. It's not just in our practice when asking a teacher questions, but also how we formulate questions ourselves and what questions do we answer ourselves from others. So the other one, Digha Nikaya, this is the one that you don't have to read, and I read through it, and in this particular sutta, the Buddha had a history of back problems. And he would often turn the Dharma talk over to Sariputta or Moggallana, his two lieutenants, or Ananda, his laissez-faire person. So, affaire de, what is the correct way of saying that? Charge d'affaires. Thank you. I couldn't think. I knew it was French sounding, and that was it. So in this particular instance, his back is hurting, and he asked Sariputta to give the talk. And it is a long, 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 long talk. He essentially summarizes every list you can imagine and goes on and on and on. Finally got to the point where he talks about these four questions. So, and he explains where this came up from, where this idea of formulating these questions. Now, at the time, the Nagata Nataputta had recently passed away. He apparently was head of the Jain sect. With his passing, the Jain ascetics split, dividing into two factions, arguing, quarreling, and fighting, continually wounding each other with barbed words. Quote, "You don't understand this teaching and training. I understand this teacher and training. What? You understand this teaching and training? You practice wrong. I practice right. I stay on topic. You don't. You said last what you should have said first. You said first what you should have said last. What you've thought so much about has been disproved. Your doctrine is now refuted. Go on, save that doctrine. You're trapped." Anyway, this is how it goes on as the Jains are fighting amongst themselves. And the people listening were disappointed with the teaching and training so poorly explained and poorly propounded, not emancipating, not leading to peace, proclaimed by someone who's not fully awakened, somebody who doesn't allow to take refuge. And then Sariputta said, there are four ways of answering questions. There is a question that should be answered definitively. A question should be answered analytically. There's a question should be answered with a counter question. There's a question that should be set aside. So those are the four, but there's also other criteria that the Buddha formulated, which I don't believe is any list, but Tanisaro Bhikkhu said these are things that he considered when answering a question. And one of the first is a person's education and culture. You know, and I thought about this, and it almost reminds me of IQ tests. When I was young, and we were all given IQ tests, and they were all based on white middle-class experience. You know, they finally did change that as far as I know. So, of course, minority people, people who weren't white middle class, would not do well. So the test should have been based on something different to test actual intelligence. So when the Buddha says a person's education, his culture, where he came from, you know, all these different criteria, he considers that before answering the question. The facets of right speech. Does anybody remember what the facets of right speech are?
Not harsh. Not harsh words.
That's right, not harsh. Telling, being truthful. Kindness. Timeliness. Usefulness. All of these come into account when answering. Is this going to, essentially, is this going to be helpful or not?
How about clear and concise?
Well, he always answered clear and concise. The elements of right speech just having to do with harm or not harming. He said the answer must not harm the person asking the question or the teacher. Not asking the question or the teacher. He looks at why. What is the motivation behind this person asking the question, which I'll go into in a moment? And does the person have the right attitude? You know, and I was thinking of these in terms of climate change. You know, because one of the things we discussed when I was more involved with it, and will be again, was how to speak to climate change deniers. And all of these are taken into account by people who have suggestions on how to talk to people about this, not in a accusatory way, and I'm right, you're wrong, but actually to come to a truth in a skillful way. And that also leads me to the Buddha never taught a truth simply because it was true. For all the reasons that I just said, he would never say an untruth. But remember, one of the facets of right speech is it timely. So I ask this in prison quite a bit. We have lots of discussions on this because in prison, gossip, innuendo, rumors, huge. You know, it's entertaining. And I've asked the man, okay, your cellie, you found out that your cellie's girlfriend is cheating on him. Do you tell him? And they ask the right questions. Well, how is he feeling? You know, is anything else going on in his life? Am I good friends? Will he believe me? Do we have some history? Is he going to think I'm making this up? All of these are the kind of things that you concern yourself with on, do I tell the truth right now or not? So it's not lying. It's, is it appropriate right at this point to offer this truth? Saraputta also came up with an interesting list, and it's called the 5 motivations for asking questions. So the first one is through stupidity and bewilderment, which kind of surprised me, but then I started thinking of some of the suttas, and some of you have done some sutta studies. The Buddha, on occasion, would call somebody foolish, ignorant. I don't think he used the word stupid, but he might have. But he would get really annoyed when somebody just completely misinterpreted what he was saying and would go out and talk about it as if they knew what they were speaking about. One of the most famous, and I think Rich gave a talk on this, is called the snake simile. And in this, there's a monk named Aritha, A-R-I-T-T-H-A. Like I've mentioned, I read these things and I never know how you pronounce them. It sounds like Aretha Franklin. Aritha? Maybe Aritha, that sounds better. So Aritha was spreading these, what are called pernicious views. He misinterpreted what the Buddha had been teaching about karma and giving a completely different take on it. And the Buddha became really, really upset with him and said, you're a foolish man. Don't teach. Don't answer questions. This is ridiculous. So he stopped. Second reason is evil desires and overwhelming greed. So an example of that is Devadatta was the Buddha's half-brother, and he is constantly trying to take over the Sangha. There's so many stories of him doing this, including trying to kill the Buddha. But one of his ways was to stand up in the Sangha and ask these questions out of greed because he wanted to take over. Again, it reminds me too of some people who are ignoring climate change, want to make money, and will ask questions that have nothing to do with the truth, but are just a ways to keep things going the way they want them to. They don't want to learn about what harm is being caused. It's just more a rhetorical game. The third is contempt. When one person so dislikes another, he will ask a question to embarrass or harass him. Well, that sounds like our political debates. We don't learn a whole lot from them, especially the one in 2016. It's just ongoing contempt. But the fourth one, here's the good news, desiring knowledge. So somebody who truly, truly wants to know something. And you can tell by the way they're asking questions. This also brings up spiritual friends. You know, if you have a really good friend and you feel that you've offended them, you can ask them, tell me how I offended you. And they will tell you. And you will learn something from it. There's no selfing in here. It's just what is really going on and wanting to know. And then the last one is testing the answer according to your own experience. In the Kalama Sutta, this is the famous sutta where the Kalama said, all these teachers are coming in. Who do we know who's right and wrong? They're all saying, do it my way or don't do it his way or whatever. And the Buddha said, test it according to your own experience, if it leads to ease and happiness, it alleviates suffering, it doesn't cause harm to yourself or others, this is the path to follow. If it causes harm to yourself or others, increases suffering, that's not the path to follow. So that's testing against your own experience. So we'll go back into the four types of questions: categorical, analytical, cross-questioning, and to put aside. So categorical questions, where there is an answer, there's no debating it, it's an answer. This is actually the basis for our whole Buddhist practice. There were questions that people asked, or the Buddha would ask himself, where the answer was always, it's the Four Noble Truths, it's dependent origination, it's the way karma is. And these are the basis of how we practice now. Categorical answers just have an answer. There's no debate about it. It's the truth according to this practice. There are inappropriate questions that people would ask, thinking that they would get a categorical answer, and including, and I'll go into this in more detail in questions that should be thrown out, what was I in the past, what will I be in the future, where did the self come from, and what will it return to? Why are these not categorical questions?
They don't have answers.
That's right. They don't have answers. That's exactly right. And we'll go into a little more detail on that. In prison, these are the kind of things, especially about God, that comes up all the time. And the question is, do you believe in God? That comes up constantly. Are you a believing woman? Are you a believing man? And I have found this most skillful thing to do is to put it aside and say, in Buddhist practice, this is not a question that we go into. You can believe whatever you like and follow your spiritual tradition, but it's not it's not something that's up for discussion here. That ends it. It takes care of it. Here's an example of a categorical answer, and this is Anguttara Nikaya 2.18. Venerable Ananda was sitting there, his attendant, and the Blessed One said to him, I say categorically, Ananda, that bodily misconduct, verbal misconduct, and mental misconduct should not be done, period. That's it. And then in Majjhima Nikaya 135, he goes into not asking who I am, but how should I be? So it's a verb rather than a noun. What do I do? Not who am I? Does that make sense? What should I be doing? Not who am I? And that would be a whole other talk about selfing and, you know, having this constricted sense of self and becoming and all of that, the Buddha's, that is causing suffering. But knowing what to do, following the Noble Eightfold Path, there is your path. There's your map. That alleviates suffering. So that's categorical, analytical. Analytical has the fewest examples in the Pali Canon, and it usually is about a misunderstanding, unskillful action, and many of them involve one of my favorite characters in the Pali Canon, King Pasenadi. I've given talks on King Pasenadi because he is such as, he's like us. He gets really dopey sometimes and asks some of the silliest questions, and he gets himself in all kind of fixes. He asks the Buddha advice on how to lose weight, and the Buddha put him on a diet. So King Pasenadi, in a couple of discourses, and one of the well-known was he said there are four castes. In the Buddha's time, there were four castes. And he said, what happens to each of these castes after death? And he said, I assume that, you know, they would each stay in their caste and they'd be born again and they'd still be in their caste because it's forever and that's just the way it is. And the Buddha reframed his question and said, what happens to people no matter what the caste is according to their karma in this life and the next? It doesn't matter what caste they're in. So he reframed it for him, and then King Bhasenadi supposedly learned something, although you keep reading about him, he doesn't seem to. He just kind of gets lost. There's another instance where there's a group of ascetics who are wandering around. The king and the Buddha are sitting there talking, and these ascetics are wandering around, and the king goes over and bows to them. Ascetics are, you know, are wandering mendicants. And he comes back to the Buddha and he says, so what do you think of those guys? Huh? They're not of your group, but they're ascetics, huh? Kind of impressive, aren't they? And the Buddha reframed it and said, you don't know anyone till you spend time with them, till you watch how they act with other people. Completely reframed it. And the king said, well, I was actually kidding you. They're actually spies of mine, and I just wanted to see what you'd say. This is King Pasenadi. This is why I find him so interesting. He's just, he's crazy. So cross-questioning is the most common method of teaching by the Buddha. And it brings me back to the original article on Chris Wallace interviewing Trump. That's the kind of thing that the Buddha would do, is cross-question. He also said that teachers must be willing to be cross-questioned about whatever teaching is going on. People should be able to ask questions. Tanisaro Bhikkhu himself said, if a teacher doesn't cross-question or allow cross-questioning, he's guilty of objectifying himself and his audience. On the one hand, the way he presents his teaching as a finished product stands on the foundation of objectification, classification, meaning I am the thinker. I am unwilling to open my thoughts to the probing of others. On the other hand, he is treating his listeners as objects, for he shows no concern for whether they understand or benefit from the logic of thought. So the Buddha, however, would not engage in cross-questioning all the time for some of the reasons I've already enumerated about the categories of people and the timeliness and that kind of things. He wouldn't engage in cross-questioning with people who are not sincere. It goes back to Sariputta's five types of people who ask questions. If he felt listeners would benefit, he would say, bring it on. Well, he didn't say bring it on, but you know what he said. And he would not engage in cross-questioning if it harmed himself or others. Tanisaro Bhikkhu thinks there are rules that the Buddha established. They're not in any kind of sutta, but there are standards of conduct that he said you can see when you do a lot of studying. And the first is, and I think these are really important for any of us who engage in a discussion or debate with somebody else, and that is the person who you are speaking to takes responsibility for his or her statements and actions. So this isn't a game. You know, this is sincere. This is somebody who truly believes in what they're saying and they have reasons for it. The second is a fair and truthful interchange and responding in a civil manner. Yeah. Third is a willingness to cross-question and be cross-questioned. And the fourth is a willingness to find and accept the truth after the cross-questioning. Wow, imagine if debates actually worked with those kind of rules. And then he also says, and you find this teaching a lot, is cross-questioning yourself is a really important question. I gave a talk a couple of years ago. I do a yearly month-long retreat in January, and I usually have a theme, and 2 years ago it was Majjhima Nikaya 19, which is the two types of thinking. And in that, I actually question myself on what is causing ease and happiness and what isn't. Literally everything in my life I would look at for that month. And I said, if it's causing ease and happiness, I will do it, not causing harm to myself or others. And if it's causing unease and unhappiness, I will not do it. And if it's causing harm to myself or others. I found out I had to eliminate most of the things in my life. Television, couldn't watch it. I realized there was just too much tension there. If I had thought it would, even though I was on retreat, I would have done it. I did allow myself to listen to chanting. I found that caused me ease. It was a really strange and wonderful experience to actually look at everything you're doing. And is this causing happiness or not? This is self-questioning. And this is one of the foundations, if not the foundation, for mindfulness in our practice. Constantly questioning what we're doing. Yeah.
So I think the hard thing for me is to fairly evaluate if the activities are helpful or not. I think oftentimes the hard ones are, it's not cut and dry, not black and white,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
TV may be sort of relaxing after a hard day at work, but in other ways it's not fulfilling or helpful.
That's right. So you have to continually cross-question yourself. Is this helpful or not? Is this causing anxiety or not? Is this helping me grow as a person or not? Is this causing harm to myself or not? For myself, when I was in retreat, when you're quiet, you start seeing things a little more deeply than just kind of every day, you know, is this TV program good or not? Mm-hmm. I realized that it caused stress. Mm-hmm. And I didn't want any stress. So I eliminated it. You might find that to be true for you or not. We each find out for ourselves. But you have to question, you know, what's going on. Your turn.
Can you talk a little bit about talking to a climate change denier? In my case, this is something I deal with every day.
Yeah.
And I would just like some wisdom on that.
That was a talk I gave, and it's kind of long, and we can talk. Actually, we're going to talk about this at the climate change meeting.
I'm not going to come to that, unfortunately.
December 18th? Okay. I will send you information on a guy who has made a science of this, and he's great.
Thank you.
You're welcome. Just send me an email and remind me.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. Okay, so the very last questions are the questions to be put aside, to not be answered. Saying that, he would not always put questions aside. Everything I'm saying here, there was always wiggle room. It was the Buddha. You know, he knew when, no, this isn't going to apply. Yeah, this is going to apply. For us, maybe we don't have that wiggle room. Maybe we should follow this a little more austerity, but I don't know. But he said there were two questions that generally he put aside. Questions that have true beneficial answer, but it's not the right time or the place. That goes back to that truth thing. You know, do I tell the truth right now or not? And the second one is, there was no benefit at all in answering this question. The most famous sutta for not answering it at all is called the interestingly enough, the Ananda Sutta, and I think a lot of you have probably heard of this one, but you haven't heard of the second one, I'll bet, that I'm going to tell you. And this is when Vajragata went to the Buddha and said, "Is there a self? Master Gotama, is there a self?" And what did the Buddha say? He said, "Nothing." It's said that if you ask a Buddha three times, he has to answer. So Vajragata asked him again, "Is there a self?" No answer. Asked him again, "Is there a self?" No answer. Eh, he got disgusted and walked off. What does this guy know? Doesn't say anything. He just sits there quietly. And so Ananda asked him, "Why, Lord, did the Blessed One not answer when asked a question by Vajragata the Wanderer?" And he answered, "Ananda, if I, being asked, is there a self, were to answer that there is a self, that would be conforming with those contemplatives and Brahmins who are exponents of eternalism. If I said there's no self, that would be conforming with those contemplatives and Brahmins who are exponents of annihilism. If I, being asked by Vajragata, is there a self, were to answer there is a self, would that be in keeping with the arising of knowledge that all phenomena are not self?" "No, Lord." He said, "Then I can't answer."
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what's that?
Why he may not have answered. It would be contradictory for him to answer that question, because if there is no self, then the no self is not going to answer. And if there is a self, the self will answer. So by not answering, he was actually saying there is no self.
That could get into a whole other talk as well. But this is where this other one comes in, which is really interesting, and it's called the Kema Sutta, and it's the exact same question, but it's asked by guess who?
King.
That's right, King Pasenadi. That's right. There he is again, and it figures he's asking this. He's been around when the Buddha says, "I won't answer." So of course he asks it, but now he goes to Kema the nun. And he says, "Now then," King Pasenadi of Kosala says, "Now then, lady," he rephrases a little differently, although this is kind of what Vishagata said too, "does the Tathagata exist after death?" Now, Tathagata is another name for the Buddha. She answers, "That great king has not been declared by the Blessed One." "Well then, lady, does the Tathagata not exist after death?" "Great king, that too has not been declared by the Blessed One." "Then does the Tathagata both exist and not exist after death?" "That too has not been declared by the Blessed One." And he goes on, he goes, "Well, you're not answering my question." And this is the king. And so she says, "Very well, great king, I will question you in return about this same matter. Answer as you see fit. What do you think, great king? Do you have an accountant or calculator or mathematician who can count the grains of sand in the river Ganges as this is how many grains of sand there are? Or can you count the buckets of water that are in the ocean and say, this is how many buckets of water are in the ocean?" "No, lady, I can't. The ocean is boundless, sands are boundless." "Even so, great king, any physical form describing the Tathagata would have to be described in this way." So essentially, it's beyond your comprehension. At least that's the way I'm interpreting it. And it's kind of useless to talk about because you're not capable of understanding it. That's my interpretation, and that's as far as it goes. But I think it's wonderful that, you know, she explained it that way. It's impossible for you to do that. Yeah.
The Blessed One.
The Buddha. And then questions to be put aside for us as lay people, what do you think that would be? What would our answer be?
Is there a heaven?
Pardon me?
Is there a heaven? Metaphysical
question. No. Our answer, if somebody was to ask us some metaphysical question or something, and it's something that we can't answer, we would just say, I don't know. I don't know, which I think is a wonderful answer, and I don't think enough people say it. It seems like we all have to have an answer all the time. And I love it when people, I don't know. And I think I've mentioned this to you. I occasionally go over to Valley Streams on Monday nights, and especially when they have Mio, Dennis, and I don't know his last name there. And he will start his Dharma talk by saying, I'm not the answer man. I probably don't have the answer, but I'll tell you what I do know from my own experience. And it's like, wow, you know, that's great. I want to hear somebody like that. I love that.
I have a question.
Yeah.
In a kingly manner. What is the best way to answer a question without an answer?
I don't know. I don't know.
Well, I think the best way to answer a question without an answer is to say, that's a very good question.
And that is a very good question. Thank you. All right, so summation. I think one of our misconceptions is thinking we're going to find the answers. And in my lifetime of 71 years now, I haven't, but I have so many questions, and that seems to be as good as it gets. And I'm grateful for the questions. And here are four reasons I believe formulating questions are better than answers. And questions push us to explore and to do more. Answers, and maybe I'm sure you found this to be true, I certainly found it for me, answers think we're done. I think Heather Sundberg or somebody was saying, yeah, I'm cooked, I'm done, you know, complete. No, we're not. There's very little about our lives that are completely done. There's always more to learn. There's always more to do and explore. And questions power humility, answers end in pride. Have you found that to be true? Somebody who just has all the answers? Yeah. Seems to be a little bit of an ego thing going on there. Questions force camaraderie with others. Answers tend to isolate us. So to be able to spend time with somebody and ask questions and look forward to it. You know, Susan Orr was one of my dearest friends. And one of the things I miss about her more than anything was I would actually write down questions when we'd get together so I could talk to her about this. What do you think about this? Have you ever had this happen? What would you do in this situation? It was wonderful to have somebody who would be willing and honest to just have this discussion about it. Some of the answers I agreed with, some didn't work with my experience, but I always loved to hear what she had to say. And questions cause us to not just spit out formulated answers, thinking that we're some expert, and we've always said this, so it's right. Questions cause us to constantly question ourselves and our answers. So I hope you consider how to apply these types of questions in your daily lives. I think they're very helpful, and that's the end of my talk. Anybody have any questions or comments? Yes, Ginger.
I understand about questions, about my viewpoint, the more you know, the more you feel like you don't know.
Mm-hmm.
Because things are vast, but As far as actions, what's important to me is somebody's integrity, that they stick by their word and they don't vacillate if their intention is followed by what their action. They don't, they do what they say, mm-hmm. they follow through with what they say and not do the opposite.
Yeah. Well, the Buddha said that being skillful, you know, for yourself and for others is the basis of this practice. Is what you're doing skillful and helpful, or is it not? And I always weigh things up against the first precept, is what I'm doing going to cause harm to myself or others? And if it is, then don't do it. And being a friend and being able to trust somebody, that's being skillful. At least that's my opinion.
But things change. People are not always the same. Like,
and you have to constantly question what's going on. This is why there is not a pat, formulaic answer. You're questioning. And I think that's what the Buddha's talking about. Anybody else have anything to that?
Well, it seems the question should be like, why do you ask that question?
Mm-hmm.
And you could do that by yourself, like, why do I want to know that? Mm-hmm. Or if I ask somebody, they to make it more of a discussion, I guess if they said, well, why do you want to know? Kind of open the doors and talk.
Right. Right. And then you have a conversation going and you will learn something about each other and maybe some truths will present themselves. Yeah. All right. Any other comments? It's 2 minutes to nine. Yes, Ian.
Thank you, Diane. I was just thinking, one of the things you're saying, the benefits of questions is that it generates that camaraderie. And I like a quote from Stephen Covey, who said, seek first to understand, then to be understood.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been working with that recently and actually thinking about climate change as I've been sort of having these discussions with my coworker. And as I stopped to try and listen and ask more questions and, you know, get my responses, put my responses aside and really listen to what he had to say, it's been really fascinating and opened up and we're on opposite sides of the debate, but it's been fantastic to ask questions and actually hear what he has to say.
And you hit it right there, and this is kind of, Jim, what I'll be sending to you is exactly that, being able to listen. Because when you're listening to somebody, you tend to look very smart.
Yes.
And people tend to want to talk to you. And the more that you have that exchange without judgment, the more open people become. And so you can change minds without even having to change minds just by being the way you are. So thank you for that. All right. A final metta. May you all be safe and protected. May you all be peaceful and happy. May you all be healthy and strong. May you all be free in this lifetime. May you go in peace.